The Tom Woods Show, episode 1802.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I've had a lot of people say that I've been keeping them sane with my commentary through my email newsletter about what's really going on with the virus. Well, if you want to know the people who keep me sane and the resources I use to find out the stuff I find out, well, I made you a list of those resources, and you can grab it over at tomwoods.com/corona. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Jeff Deist is on the program. He is a consistent favorite even of the host. And I wanted to just talk to him about the year 2020, do kind of a year in review, this miserable year. Of course, you know Jeff Deist is president of the Mises Institute. He was the last chief of staff that Congressman Ron Paul had, and an all-around extremely interesting and smart guy. Without even trying, he's just constantly, as he walks around, he's shedding, you know how people say they're shedding virus? He's shedding insights without even meaning to or trying. And I just wanted to review what the heck we've just been through with him. So Jeff, welcome back.
Tom, thank you so much and Happy New Year to you.
Well, Happy New Year to you too. You are rounding out 2020. You are the last thing anyone will remember about the Tom Woods Show in 2020, for better or worse.
Well, I'm told that the 2000th episode is planned for sometime in 2021. Is that correct?
That is correct. Early October. I should have the date pretty darn soon in Orlando. So be there. It's going to be bigger and better than the 1000th episode where you were present. I may have something I want, well, you know, with your consent that you may want to do as part of it. We'll talk about that off the air, but it's going to be an absolute blast, I'm telling you.
Okay, I'll look forward to that.
And it doesn't cost anything. Like, people can attend and it doesn't cost them a thing. They get an evening's worth of free entertainment. I was at dinner the other night with two world-class marketers who know me, sort of, and they know my market, sort of. And I told them I was doing this event and that I wasn't charging anything to get in. And they were ripping their hair out at what a stupid decision that was. And I could not get across to them that sometimes I do want to do something as a gesture of goodwill, and I want to have as many people there as possible. And this is not going to, that wouldn't make me enough money to be worth the trouble of charging it in the first, like, I don't want, that's not how I want to make my living. I don't want to charge people to my 2000th episode. So that's what I'm doing. I don't care if the marketing gods say it's a mistake. It's not a mistake. I'm right about this. All right. That's my battle. Let's talk about other things. Let's start with where we are as the year comes to an end. We'll try not to talk exclusively about the virus, because my gosh, have I said almost everything that seems like there is to say about that. But let's say a little something about Joe Biden and what's likely to come. I keep seeing a graphic popping up in my social media to the effect that the Black Lives Matter movement is very unhappy with the Biden-Harris ticket, because they say we went out of our way to endorse them and vote for them, and now it's been X days, 30-something days, and they still have refused to meet with us. So assuming that that is true, that that's an accurate graphic, my sense of that is BLM just met the two-party system. And in particular, they met one of the parties, the Democrats. But in particular, a particular kind of Democrat, namely the Biden wing. What do you make of that?
Well, it's to be expected. I mean, that's what politicians do. In other words, you're supposed to be able to take your base for granted. And that's exactly what Democrats do. They expect to get 90% plus of Black votes. And in general, they do. Now, this time around, they are freaking out, and perhaps with some justification, over the fact that it appears Trump made some pretty significant inroads, both with Black and Hispanic voters in terms of their numbers. And this is a story that the mainstream media won't touch, because they don't want to create a narrative or create any snowball effect, like that Republicans are becoming the working class party, which happens to include a lot of Black folks. They'll never cover or write that story, because they know perfectly well that they're in the business of crafting narratives, not reporting news. So the idea that BLM isn't being heard by the Biden administration, I mean, let's face it, BLM is not a rank and file black folks movement. It's not an urban movement. It is a movement of academic and media types. So it's not some sort of grassroots thing. But look, this is what happens. I mean, Biden is, he is what he is. He's a very, very mediocre creature. If you were to go back 30 or 40 years ago and ask U.S. senators, you know, do you think this guy, this new guy in the Senate, Biden, will ever be president? They would laugh their asses off because he was always a mediocrity, a lightweight. And frankly, the Senate used to be a significant cut above the U.S. House. In other words, senators tended to be wealthier. They tended to have more Ivy League pedigrees. They tended to be smarter. They tended to come from, ritzier backgrounds, let's just say. And there was a real difference. There was sort of a patrician air to the Senate. And that lasted at least through Watergate, probably, perhaps even beyond. Even my time working with Dr. Paul, when I got there in the early 2000s, there was still a difference. You know, people like Michelle Bachmann weren't in the Senate. People like Bernie Sanders weren't in the Senate at that time. You know, obviously Michelle Bachmann was never a senator, but I mean, the kind of people who have gone on from the House to the Senate, that was very, very rare back then. It just wasn't a thing. And so if you look at Biden, you think, was he really ever Senate material in the old school sense? I think not. Delaware is a tiny state, basically a glorified county. The DuPont family basically ran it politically for some time, so he obtained their blessing. He's always been a hack. He's always been a fraud. He's a plagiarist. He's dumb. He's incurious. He is wrong on virtually every issue. I've never heard him say anything good on any issue, really. I mean, I guess maybe he's okay on marijuana or something. I'm not sure. I take pains to not study him. He's going to be in our faces for the next few years, at least until he dies. And, I think the BLM people deserve to have the football pulled away from them, like Lucy, for supporting this chump. And I have absolutely zero sympathy.
Well, understood. Now, I want to, by contrast, ask a more, happier question, let's say. How would you say the Mises Institute came through 2020?
Well, it was a very tough year. We're one of the few organizations which continued to have events, live events, in-person events throughout the year. We didn't board up our windows and go home and tell everybody to work from home. We had events safely. We had events without COVID. And we had tremendous turnout at those events because people were so sick of being cooped up and so sick of not being around like-minded people and seeing faces and just having that social interaction that, you know, we really had to turn people away from some of the venues. And we were we had to change some of those venues because certain states and certain hotels were no longer taking people. We had to work around that, and that was okay. We certainly respect and appreciate the venues that did have us. And we certainly respect and appreciate people who don't want to come out and don't think we should, you know, be holding events because of COVID. Those people are welcome to stay home. Those people are welcome to watch live or anything. So, we had a great schedule of events. Obviously, our focus was shifted somewhat when the COVID crisis hit back in February and March because we had to sort of go to the ramparts to oppose any sort of government lockdowns. And I won't speak for everyone at the Mises Institute, but certainly what I consider a deranged and unhinged overreaction to a very survivable virus. Viruses are part of human existence. We've always dealt with them. We've always continued to go to work, continued to produce goods and services. So, that was a big part of our year, coming out strongly back in March against the lockdowns. And from a fundraising perspective, we're very, very fortunate to be robust. And, you know, overall, it was a terrible year for America, and we certainly felt that pain. But, you just got to soldier on. And I think that COVID, with respect to the Mises Institute, was one of those things like the Patriot Act or the invasion of Iraq, where you have to oppose it lock, stock, and barrel. By oppose it, I mean the government reaction to it. And you're going to burn a little bit of political capital with your fans and your donors. That's just part of it. There are certain things where they're so core to the Mises Institute's mission that we say, hey, some people are going to disagree and say, no, these lockdowns are justified and there's a public health problem here and, you know, your exhalations can theoretically be a form of aggression against others and yada, yada. We've heard all these arguments ad nauseum, but we disagree. And so we just focused on the lockdowns for a while. But of course, far more importantly was the money issue, which is always there, always lurking behind everything this depraved federal government of ours does. And, you know, it's never shown its ugly fangs more than this year. I mean, this is completely untenable. The notion that we can have, you know, like what, 75% of people sitting at home, not producing any goods or services, and somehow we can bounce back from that in a V-shaped recovery. I mean, Tom, some of these states are down 40% or more in their tax revenue. Okay, 40%. So if you think they're not going to be coming to Uncle Joe Biden for a bailout, you are crazy. And where's that money going to come from? We all know where it's going to come from. It's not going to come from taxation. It's not going to come from, you know, some V-shaped bounce back of these newly hyper productive companies. But what's really shocking, one of the sort of great untold stories of 2020, which I hope the Mises Institute can help somewhat tell in 2021, is how companies found out that they can have almost as good bottom line with not nearly as good top line. So what I mean by that is a lot of companies cut costs. As you can imagine, a lot of companies tried to shed debt if they could. A lot of companies lamented the lack of cash on their balance sheet from stock purchases over the last few years, that sort of thing. And so what we found is in certain industries that by cutting your expenses, even though your top line gross revenue went down, your bottom line net profit maybe didn't go down very much. And so that tells you that there's a real restructuring of the economy going on out there. And a lot of people in lower skilled jobs, a lot of people in service industries, a lot of people who are more vulnerable financially are going to find themselves, I think, not being snapped back up in the new economy of 2021, which is going to be more of a techie distribution type economy. So that's very frightening. And the fact that governments were complicit, if not cheering these lockdowns, that so many people in politics and government were behind this, and that so many people in politics and government have allowed basically the financialized economy, which is utterly dependent on the Fed in many respects, to create, you know, winners out of already these huge companies with distribution chains like Amazon and Walmart, and to do so much damage to mom and pop, especially in the restaurant business. I mean, folks, drive around your town and wow, for my little college town of 75,000 people, we've lost tens and dozens of restaurants. And are they going to come back? I mean, what, with a PPP loan, with $1,200, with masks and 50% dining and takeout? No. Restaurants barely make it with 100% capacity and lots of people inside drinking, you know, because alcohol is where they make their margins. So we really haven't grasped the enormity of the situation at all, because everyone was so focused on Trump versus Biden and COVID and the dangers of COVID. So we haven't really grasped what we've done. And so now in the cold, hard winter light of 2021, we are going to start to feel it. And honestly, Trump may be far better off not being president. This may be the greatest thing that ever happened to him. He can go down to Mar-a-Lago and pontificate and not have to deal with what appears to be coming. And so all Joe Biden knows how to do is tax and spend and print. I mean, this is a guy who, by his appointment or proposed appointment of Janet Yellen to Treasury, is just flashing, you know, more of the same. Okay, they're out of ideas, they're out of ammo, and I think it's going to be ugly. I really do. So that's hopefully where the Mises Institute continues to fill a role. It is gratifying to me to get emails from people saying thank you for X, Y, and Z, for explaining this, for sending me this book, for holding this event. You know, you guys make me feel sane, etc. But it's not enough, and clearly, money is going to be one of the big stories of the 21st century, and people better wake up to that and stop thinking it's some back burner snoozy issue of for monetary wonks or something like that. It's not. It's coming soon to a town near you in the form of inflation. And I'm not just some cranky Austrian permabear saying that. Ray Dalio is saying that. Jerome Powell is warning about that. So this is coming home, Tom.
Well, let me follow up with that, because it seems like the appropriate time to ask, with a question that Daniel McAdams and I handled on a panel that we did at the Mises Institute Symposium with Ron Paul back in early November, but that I'm not sure you yourself answered, and I wanted to get your answer. There have been so far two theories as to what 2021 holds for us under a President Biden in particular. One is that because this is a crisis and governments never want to give up powers they get in a crisis, they're just going to double down and it's going to be lockdowns and masks for as far as the eye can see. The other theory is that suddenly the PCR testing gets reformed and we start getting a more accurate picture of what's happening. The vaccine or vaccines come into play, and that serves as a fig leaf for them. But that in general, what Biden does are some cosmetic things at the beginning, and he surrounds himself by people in white coats. And then after a certain number of months, he declares victory when the thing naturally goes the way it was going to go anyway. I am very, very, very much inclined in the second direction, but I'm curious about your opinion.
I guess I would say yes, because even if they didn't have all of the activities planned and the vaccines and all that, I think herd immunity would probably be starting to develop anyway. And as the one physician out at Stanford tells us, herd immunity is not an approach to dealing with COVID. It's just a reality. It's just something that happens with all viruses. So it's not something where that's the government's plan is to create herd immunity. It happens whether you plan it or not. So that's that's sort of an allegory for the marketplace itself. Now, on the radio this morning, I heard an epidemiologist talking about how you need two rounds of this vaccine, but by let's say June or July, if something like 70% of Americans have had the two rounds, then that's sufficient and we'll be A-okay and this pandemic will be over. So, that's possible. And certainly Joe Biden will take credit for this. But whatever happens, again, this is about perception. Politics is always about perception. And that's why Joe Biden didn't win the election. He prevailed. Two different things. Regardless of who got the most votes, I have no idea what happened in some of those disputed states. I mean, who knows? And let's say he did win. Let's say he won both the popular and electoral college votes. Fine. But that's not really the vote. The vote is public perception. And that is a multi-pronged form of warfare where you've got media, you've got social media, you've got, state parties, you've got, so many people involved. And on multiple fronts, Biden won the war. He won the war of perception. He had his lawyers lined up. He had the media lined up. He created that phony office of the president-elect. He had press conferences talking about who he's going to appoint. So all that led to a sense of Biden had won, and thus he won, because politics is perception. That's all it is. So when it comes to COVID and treating it and curing it, or however you want to view it, and Biden taking the credit, of course, that's all a matter of perception, not fact. I mean, the fact might be that if we had just done nothing— that we might be far better off than we are today. I mean, that's certainly possible. I mean, if we didn't have 24-hour cable news and we didn't have social media and the media landscape was something more like 1985, we may never even really have heard much about this. We may have read something on the back of the New York Times. There's a big outbreak of a nasty flu in China. And then we might have, fast forward a month. There, this flu that developed in China appears to have affected a lot, some cities in Italy. And then, 2 months later, a month later, whatever, New York City and New Jersey having a particularly bad flu season and hospitals jammed, and that might have been it. And that, and think how different our perception would be. And you notice amazingly now there's no flu cases. Pharmacies across the country in the United States are reporting virtually no prescribing of Tamiflu. I mean, Tamiflu is the cheap generic go-to for most doctors, come November, December through the winter, for flu. And the idea that there's no flu in America, flu has been eradicated. No, flu has not been eradicated. What's happening is that there's, you know, COVID is sort of a layering type diagnosis, which is going on to all kinds of things. So you're seeing people with flu plus COVID or obesity plus COVID or, you know, whatever kind of comorbidity is all being dragged into a big bucket of COVID diagnosis so that we can juice these numbers and create perception. So, you know, trying to circle back here to my point, this is about perception. And Joe Biden is going to have a hell of a lot easier time at winning the battle of perception because the media wants to help him. You know, I mean, this is obvious that the media is totally in the bag for this clown, this mediocrity. But they're also looking to push him out, I think. I can't recall an election in my lifetime, or even historically perhaps, where so many people really expected the vice president to become president in the first term. Either through incapacitation or death of Mr. Biden. So that's unusual. And this is a woman, Kamala Harris, who did very poorly in the primaries. Nobody voted for this woman. Nobody wanted her. If you recall, Klobuchar did better than her. Tulsi did better than her. Pocahontas did better than her. So no Democrats voted for her and no Republicans voted for her. And yet she's probably at least 50% likely to be the next president without an election. What do you think of that?
Yeah. That's the really astonishing thing. Like, even you put aside all the silliness about democracy, that really is the classic case. Now, I'm looking right now at a chart from Germany. This chart shows the daily death trends since March. And in this chart, we see a small hill in late March, going through April, and continuing a little bit into May, but not overwhelming. And then it's pretty quiet for a while. And everybody says, well, Germany did exactly the right thing. That's why. It's because they behaved themselves and they wore masks and they complied and whatever. That's the explanation. There's no need to investigate. We already know a priori. That must be because they all complied. And then by an interesting coincidence, Jeff, after 8 months of mask wearing, all of a sudden, the beginning of November, everybody in Germany at the same time decided to stop complying all at once. So that now there's a much larger hill on the graph. And instead of the top day of deaths being about 300 or so, the top day is over 800. Now, this won't cause anyone to go back and say, you know, because you're talking about perception. If we were somehow in charge of perception creation, that is to say, by having influence over what graphs the public saw, well, the perception there would be, this seems to be a pretty big outbreak, despite the fact that they've done everything they were asked to do. Maybe there's no connection between these things at all. Maybe when we look at the Midwest around Thanksgiving and the graphs all look the same, state after state, no matter what the policy was, maybe something else is going on here. It's incredible to me that you could look at a graph like this, and this could be replicated time and again, that you could look at this and say, this just means they need to stay home harder. Mask up, put three masks on. That would be the conclusion. Instead of saying, maybe I misunderstood what happened in the first wave of this. Maybe I misunderstood this because clearly this can't be explained by lack of compliance. That's all they can think of is lack of compliance. We didn't do it enough. It is exactly like Keynesianism. It's never, the whole thing is juvenile and makes no sense. It's always, we haven't done enough of it. I don't even know what I expect of you to from this, and I don't want to dwell too much on this more than is necessary, but when you were talking about politics as perception, I just couldn't help thinking about, I'm surrounded by charts that undermine everything they're telling us, and they've still bamboozled half the public.
Well, I suspect that in those 800 daily deaths, some of those are, they're playing fast and loose with whether that's actually COVID that is the cause of that. So who knows? But nonetheless, there's, you know, when it comes to people whose reflexive attitude is for government to act, and to act more, to do something, they'll simply never accept an explanation at variance with that because it's just ingrained in them that, you know, the reason something good is happening is because government did something. The reason something bad is happening is because government didn't do something it should have done because, you know, the West is in the thrall of libertarian policy, which a lot of folks on the left believe. A lot of people think that the Kochs have sort of turned America into this dog-eat-dog, predatory, libertarian dystopia. out of an Ayn Rand novel where we're all fighting each other for the scraps of capitalism. I mean, there's plenty of people who believe that. And, you know, you have to look at things through that lens. And so the perception game is easy for our friends on the left when they've had little kids in their clutches since they were 5 years old.
Hey, everybody, let's take a quick minute to improve your life by reminding you about my old friend John Bush, whom I've known since the first Ron Paul presidential campaign. He's been a guest on the Tom Woods Show several times. We did a whole episode on kratom, which is a natural remedy that's helped a lot of people with chronic pain, stress, and anxiety, energy, and focus, even overcoming addiction. You can hear the full interview I did with John on this at tomwoods.com/kratom. Well, apparently, after that interview, he had a pretty big surge in sales from listeners. We've had a lot of people reporting they've had profound results with it. People saying they feel better than they've felt in years. I just got an email from somebody saying he used to drink every single night just to be able to get to sleep. He doesn't have to do that anymore now that he's using Kratom instead. And it can have great results like this for you too, but you won't know until you try it. And John's making it really easy to do that because he's giving you some for free. He put together an offer you can find, along with our interview, over at tomwoods.com/kratom. All you have to do is pay for shipping, and he'll send you an ounce to try free of charge. So if you want to see what all the fuss is about, head on over to tomwoods.com/kratom, listen to the interview, and take advantage of his free offer. That's tomwoods.com/kratom, K-R-A-T-O-M. Let me ask you one other thing. I think you actually did a whole episode with our friend Pete Quinones on this. At the, I guess it was the Ron Paul talk. Is that where you did the talk, the imposed and the imposed upon, or was that at Jekyll Island?
It was at Jekyll Island. It's a theme I've just been writing about and developing a little bit because I think there's a big disconnect on that score.
Yeah, and you're making a small book out of this. Can you just run down the thesis of that? Because it's something that in a way we know, but the way you explain it, it just seems to illuminate so much.
Well, I think you start with the premise that progressives won the 20th century in the West. It was a rout. It wasn't even close. The old right, which is the political movement with which I identify, lost in terms of property and freedom. Okay, so if you look at the 20th century, you find things like two horrific world wars. You find our quagmires in Vietnam and Korea. You find the imposition in the United States of a new central bank. You find the imposition of an income tax. You find New Deal programs in the 1930s, including Social Security, retirement insurance. You find Great Society programs in the 1960s, and really sweeping changes from the Supreme Court in terms of our understanding of all kinds of things in some of the key cases from the 1960s. So you put all this in a blender, and what comes out is that you had, in my opinion, a very illiberal century in terms of, you know, the Misesian understanding of what liberalism is, which starts with property and spreads out from that through to peace and non-interventionism and even self-determination in the form of secession to allow for a safety valve for democratic minorities or political minorities of whatever type in any society. So what passes for 20th century liberalism in the West, in our sort of modern mainstream conception today, is very different than what we might call the 19th century Misesian conception of liberalism. So I think that's a huge split even amongst, I hate to use this term, but amongst libertarian circles, is was the 20th century in the West a liberal triumph or was it an illiberal disaster? That's a pretty serious question to answer, I think. And I would argue that in terms of our great grandparents' understanding of property and freedom, that it was not a liberal century. The progressives won. They won all those things I mentioned. So today, because we don't understand that progressives, and there are right progressives too. Don't get me wrong. I'm not necessarily saying progressive means left, but progressive is someone who believes that history has an arc, that there's a deterministic or inevitability to all this. And who used to say that, by the way? Socialists. That things are deterministic and that what human beings need to do is just get with the program and be a little more malleable and perfect themselves because they're getting in the way of this arc when they do stupid things like vote for Brexit or don't elect Hillary Clinton. So because progressives believe this so thoroughly, they also have been able to twist things, I would argue, both, you know, in media in academia, in the public mind, that somehow they are the imposed upon. In other words, the people have been pushing throughout the 20th century. Anytime they receive a little bit of pushback, they say, oh my God, look at these reactionaries, look at these oppressive forces, look at the right, look at whatever it might be. And so you have this split in America. And there's a lot of ways we could look at it. The recent brouhaha over calling Jill Biden doctor, and certainly educational doctorates shouldn't be, but you know, I know you and I might differ a little bit on the PhD designation, because there's a lot of PhDs who are nobodies. But there's MDs who are nobodies too, of course. But you know, this idea that, you know, Jill Biden, who has had a privileged and just absolutely unbelievable life, okay, a life which she didn't really add much in terms of goods or services to the Western world. Right?
All right, I was trying to keep quiet back here.
Okay. So nonetheless, she got some PhD, or what they call a PhD in education, and apparently her dissertation was a rambling mess. Okay, so now there's this idea that somehow she is oppressed or put upon because this patriarchal West or whatever, or this sexist America doesn't want to call her doctor, doesn't want to recognize her vast achievements. You know, it's like, come on. She was married to another guy and then a U.S. senator, and she hitched her star to a guy who happened to become president. I mean, she is in no way oppressed. But the story unraveled on social media and everywhere, like, this is still a really sexist society. And that's why Dr. Jill Biden, her critics won't call her doctor and won't give her due and this and that. Well, that's all absurd, okay? That's a small example of the oppressors, in other words, progressives like Joe Biden, who have had their way, acting like the victims. Okay, and all of this goes beyond government policy. We're not just talking about state action. We're talking about, you know, media and perception and all kinds of things which are, in theory, voluntary. Okay, but I would say the larger example of this, and maybe the most important example of this for these lousy culture wars that we're suffering through right now, because so much is decided in Washington, D.C., unfortunately, is the secularists versus the religionists, right? I mean, along with those other things I mentioned in the 20th century, especially since the 1960s, there's been an absolute rout of secularism in the West, an absolute rout, both in the public sphere and in the private sphere in terms of people not going to church, not being religious, not attending, you know, all that sort of thing. I mean, basically, Christianity went from being almost a centerpiece of American cultural and social life to being almost a footnote in American cultural and social life. Maybe that's overstating it a bit, but nonetheless, I mean, if you talk to 20-somethings, and you know, okay, they're not very religious. It's just the truth. So religious people in the United States, particularly Christians, feel put upon. They feel set upon by political correctness, by academia, by media, by a secular environment in pop music, in movies, in literature, in magazines, in fashion, in the performing arts, in theater, and they feel like they're losing, and they are, they're losing the Christian part of society, and that there's this secular juggernaut which is pushing and pushing and pushing them. And whenever they try to fight back, like, you know, let's get Amy Coney Barrett on the Supreme Court because she'll, you know, vote our way on abortion or something like that. You know, they consider that pushing back. They consider that self-defense, we might say, in the broad cultural way. And so, but you introduce somebody like Amy Coney Barrett into the conversation, and the left media reacts as though they're the oppressed. They say, oh my gosh, these Christian theocrats are attempting to oppose their views on the rest of us and ban abortion. And here they've got this crazy Catholic woman who has, you know, 7 or 8 kids, ho, 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 you know. How dare they bring up this radical fundamentalist Catholic and try to put her on the Supreme Court to take away our rights? So the left is exceedingly skillful in the midst of a secular rout. Amy Coney Barrett is going to do zippity-doo-da-day. I mean nothing. Okay, if you're counting on Amy Coney Barrett, I know a couple of people who had her as students when they went to Notre Dame Law. They had her for constitutional law there. They said she's a very nice woman, a very smart woman, obviously brilliant, capable, et cetera. There's no argument there. But they said that her, you know, she's not going to rock the boat on the Supreme Court, was their opinion, versus, a Clarence Thomas, let's say. So she's not going to do anything. But think of how skillful the left is in making it seem like they're the imposed upon. that, you know, the Mike Huckabees of the world are going to are just one Supreme Court justice away from imposing their Christian theocracy on us unless we fight back. You know, we're the imposed upon, and we need to apply self-defense to keep America, you know, democratic and secular. So there's this clash there. Who are the imposers and who are the imposed upon? Now, I would argue in this sense, Christian America is the imposed upon and the secular people are the imposers. Now, they would argue otherwise. But it seems to me that's an important thing to figure out. That's important to understand. Don't you agree, Tom, that if we understand that better, that ought to guide how we view the political landscape and the broader cultural landscape. I mean, who's pushing and who's just playing defense and trying to push back? That seems to me a fundamental question that's underlying everything we talk about, whether in libertarianism or otherwise.
Well, just look at the political landscape or cultural landscape over the past 50 years. Ask which side has made gains and which side has retreated. Almost, you don't even have to look in the aggregate. You can look in individual cases. You can look at the forest and the trees. And I think it's like zero for one side and entirely for the other. Now, there'll be people on that other side who are unhappy because they, you know, this is not the progressivism that I believe in, whatever kind of nitpicking. But it's pretty clear which way the wind is blowing in the U.S. And you're right. They've got everything they could ask for, and everything they demand, they get within 3 years. And everyone retreats and doesn't want to look like a bad person for opposing whatever it is. And then they continue to act as if they're put upon by overwhelming oppression. Yeah, that's real, and it's bizarre. It's crazy because it's not only is it untrue, but I think it has the effect of making people wonder if they're crazy.
Right, and it's also why I have zero time for libertarians who refuse to acknowledge or grasp this.
Yes, what a waste of time, absolute waste of time. Yeah.
But devil's advocate. There are plenty of people on the left, if you go read Jacobin magazine, which I do, who would say, no. There has been a conservative revolution and a libertarian conservative revolution in America. You know, back in the 40s and 50s, we had stronger unions. We had far more equal pay scales between CEOs and average workers. Yes, you know, blacks and women had it horrible, but we fixed that a little bit in the 60s. And so what's happened is there's been a right-wing revolution from the Reagan-Thatcher era, which decimated unions and hurt pay, and minimum wage hasn't kept up. And we've got these radicals like Scalia on the Supreme Court, and the Republican Party has moved way to the right and da-da-da. I mean, they would say that and they believe that. So, I mean, let's just put that out there.
Yeah, I hear that. And I guess that would probably be the best example of devil's advocate. But I think that one's trickier to answer because some of those things are due not to any concerted policy on anybody's part, but because of the dropping of trade barriers, which I suppose that is a policy, but not a domestic policy, really, an international policy of more free trade, more international competition. You're not going to be able to keep your crazy union scale in that kind of environment. It's just impossible. You wouldn't be able to compete. But on the other hand of that, you have a dramatic increase in the supply of goods available and whatever. So I could come back with that. But I guess I would say, how many of you people on the left feel like your career is in danger if you speak out about the decline in unions? Probably not at all. It would never even occur to you that would be an issue. Whereas if we say the wrong thing about the virus, that's it. That's the end of our YouTube channel. Or if I refuse to comply with some whatever the latest crazy demand is of me at work, maybe I get fired. Or maybe, you know, I mean, in other words, they're not acknowledging that the average person with perfectly normal, defensible views is constantly having to ask whether he should say or even think a certain thing. They themselves never have to ask that question. So as terrible as they claim that the situation is and that there's actually been a right-wing backlash, it must be an awfully mild right-wing backlash if the ones perpetrating it are the ones who have to watch their mouths and the alleged victims can blab about anything they want.
Well, and, you know, the reactionary slur, which is common out there. Okay, but if we look at all those things I mentioned in the 20th century, central banking, income tax, great society programs, yeah, I'm against those things. So I'm reacting to those in a negative way. So you know, to be someone who cares about political liberty, I think, is to simply have to deal with this slur of reactionary because, you know, as Murray Rothbard put it, and I'm paraphrasing him, the left engineers the great leaps forward and the Republicans consolidate the gains. So this choo-choo train is going one way. You know, it's going fast and it's heavy and it's hard to slow, much less stop. So that's certainly the way I see things today.
Well, I don't know how to conclude this because I like to go into, you know, I read Mises Institute literature and it's very upbeat and positive about what can be done by people with the right ideas. But then sometimes I'll talk to one of our folks on the podcast and it just seems very dreary and unhappy. And here we are at the end of a rather unhappy year. And I want to go out on the highest possible note we can. Are you up to that challenge, Jeff Deist?
Well, let me throw this out there. An incredibly upbeat thing to consider. I have gotten to know, I wouldn't say I'm friends with, but I'm acquainted with Emily Schles, the great historian who, she lives in Washington, D.C., but also up in Plymouth Notch, Vermont, because she heads up the Calvin Coolidge Foundation up there. And she does some great work with high school students there. She requires them to debate in a, you know, on your feet oral format and this and that. And so she's certainly not someone who views the state the way you and I do. But I really am fascinated by her history and reading her work on Coolidge and the Great Society. She's got a great book on the 60s, and which she views as far more revolutionary than the 30s, by the way, because of what the Supreme Court did. But she made a point earlier this year during the midst of COVID. She said, you know, imagine how great our economy is when we still have grocery stores and gas stations and ATMs and hardware stores and all these other things full of goods and services we need, even when our crazy government is just doing insane things. I mean, we have such a widespread distribution network of goods and services in this country that even when government just attempts to blow it up and roll a hand grenade into the proceedings, I mean, this stuff still gets to us. And so there is a remarkable buoyancy to our economy because Americans expect a level of material comfort. In other words, people talk about entitled Americans, and that's true, but it's also good. You know, when we're at the grocery and you're standing and there's six lines and one of them's long and everyone's getting fidgety and kind of looking around, you know, the grocery store rushes and open up a new lane, everyone's getting PO'd. Okay, well, 40 years ago in Russia, when you were waiting in line at the grocery, nobody opened up a new line. You know, that just wasn't how it was. So we have this, we still have this underlying optimism in this country, I guess, for lack of a better term. And we still have an entrepreneurial energy that you just don't find in Europe. You just don't. And, you know, is it dying? Yeah, it probably is suffered. It's probably had some injuries in 2020 with COVID because now we're creating this mentality where we all sit home and get a check from the government, but it's still there. And there are people starting companies and making money in 2020 in just incredible ways because necessity is the mother of invention. Maybe they were laid off. Maybe their business plummeted, you know, all kinds of things. So there's a strong case to be made that no matter what government does, as long as we have at least certain freedoms, we work our way around it, that markets find a way, which is to say human beings go out and do innovative things to work around it. And so, you know, you can view government as just another impediment, like a hurricane comes along or something. You know. So it was really interesting when she said that. I think, you know, what a country where you still go to the grocery and we still have the amount of choice we have, and someone who makes, let's say, $12 an hour at a basic service job in this country could, if they were frugal, could easily eat a full day's worth of calories on that 1 hour of wages. You know, you could go to Taco Bell, you could buy cheaper stuff at the grocery, rice and beans, you know, you could buy a little bit of meat, eggs, that sort of thing. I mean, that is an incredible testament to the power of markets and to their natural tendency, their natural evolution towards deflation, which is the deflation and civilization go hand in hand. More and more goods and services, which were once only available to the wealthiest folks, trickle down and become available to middle class and even poor folks. The poorest people in your town have a cell phone in their hands, which has basically the sum of human knowledge in it. as long as they pay their bill. So let's cheer deflation, the natural form, the natural process of people getting richer, and let's fight government spending and deficits, and especially the Fed, which are the enemies of deflation, which are the inflationary forces in society. And let's take good cheer from what Amity Schley said.
Wow. Okay. Well, you rose to the occasion, Jeff. Thank you very much. I have to end on a good note after all the sour ones of this year. And I'm so sick of people talking about how terrible a year it is, even though that's all I do all the time. But I am hopeful for 2021. And, you know, where I live, I have tickets to see Rob Schneider, the comedian at the King Center in Melbourne, which is a regular venue I've been to many times. I have two concerts I've bought tickets for already, going on a couple of major trips. So I'm acting like nothing's changed. But I hope that the kinds of things that I'm able to experience in the relatively free state of Florida get extended throughout to everywhere throughout 2021, including Alabama, Jeff, including Alabama.
Well, I'll just wish you and Jenna and your girls a great new year.
Thank you, Jeff, and to you and Paula and your kids as well. And I look forward to a terrific 2021 for the Mises Institute. Thanks a lot. All right, folks, here's something that's going to be of interest to all of you, okay? I think most of us, at the very least, are sympathetic to agorism, if not agorists ourselves. And of course, you know, I hope, what an agorist is. These are folks who believe in the market economy as the place where peaceful interaction takes place, as opposed to the political realm, which is driven by violence, where coerced transactions take place. And the agorist thinks that as much of human life as possible, preferably all of it, should take place in the marketplace where people engage with each other on a voluntary basis. And the agorist wants to try to find what freedom we can in the various nooks and crannies of life so that we can all live freer and we can trade with other people who want to give us what we want and vice versa. So, for example, anytime you have a yard sale and you don't tell the IRS how much you earned from your yard sale, you're being an agorist. Or anytime it says 55 miles an hour, and like Sammy Hagar, you can't drive 55, you are being an agorist. Well, a Tom Woods Show listener has created a website, agorist.market. So it's not .com, it's agorist.market. It connects what Sam Konkin called the counter-economy buyers with sellers, in order to help withdraw our financial support from some of the bad corporations who are feeding the politicians and the banksters. What a great idea. So go check this out, agorist.market. That's agorist.market. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1802. And remember, the last couple of weeks of December, I'm doing just two episodes a week. So I'll do another couple toward the end of next week because I take a little time off in December. But remember also, especially as we go into a new year and you start making your resolutions, one of them might be start a website, right? You've been meaning to do that. If you want to start a website, don't start it until you go to tomwoods.com/publicity and you see all the goodies I'm offering you to help get your website off to a successful start. And that means help from me in the form of publicity of the sort I just gave to agorist.market, also some free tutorials and membership in my private bloggers group for starters. So check that out at tomwoods.com/publicity. All you got to do is just get your hosting through my link and you don't pay 1 cent extra. If anything, you get a great price and I give you all these free bonuses. So tomwoods.com/publicity is where to go before you start that site. And I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.